Hello and welcome once again to Lichtman and Rizoff live, in air quotes, at Grassroots Tavern. I'm John Lichtman, contributor for The House Next Door and Corporate Hack.
I'm Vadim Rizoff, I live here.
And as always, Keith Ulick is here to moderate and make sure that we are not going off course too much.
I've got the whip, be careful guys.
Join us tonight are two special guests, as we all crowd around the table. Gentlemen, if you want to introduce yourselves.
I'm Grady from Subway Cinema.
Grady Hendricks.
Yes.
And I'm Mark Walco, also from Subway Cinema.
The men from Subway Cinema.
And they are joining us tonight to talk about the gamblers, gangsters, and other anti-heroes, the Japanese Yakuza movie, presented by the Asia Society and the Japan Foundation, which occurs March 6th through April 17th, 2008. Pretty much, it starts out with, I will also use the English title because I'm going to butcher the Japanese if I try it. But we have A Tale of Two Yakuza, directed by Tomomi Uchida.
I can say the Japanese title.
Oh, thank you. Go ahead.
Jinsei Gekijo.
Ah, wow.
Oh, well, I hear people lining up and buying tickets already. They're like, Jinsei Gekijo.
And it's being marketed, at least in the press, as a classical gangster picture with the... I don't know how you... Like, what is a classical Yakuza movie? Wouldn't that just be tradition versus honor?
Given the whole Gary Ninja?
It depends on what year it's from. I mean, Mark knows better than me, but it all depends on where it's from.
I mean, Uchida, I mean, it's weird that they started the series with this. I haven't actually seen, out of all five of the films that they're showing, Jinsei Gekijo is the one I have not seen, and unfortunately I'm not going to be in town when it's screened. But Uchida was never really known particularly as a Yakuza director. Uchida was actually the subject of a retrospective 2 or 3 years ago in Japan at Tokyo Film X, and then I think the retrospective went to the Rotterdam Film Festival. And I've heard tell that BAM is going to be featuring some of his movies in April in a small series, but I haven't seen the lineup yet. He's really an underrated director, even in Japan, which is typically, you know, how they choose the subject of these Tokyo Film X retrospectives. He's done swordplay films, he's done a few Yakuza films, and he's done some modern dramas. Out of the movies of his that I've seen, which are not that many, the best one I think is this one called Fugitive from the Past, which showed at MoMA maybe 2 or 3 years ago as part of this like Classics of Japan series that they did, this huge like 3-month-long series that they had. They showed Fugitive from the Past, a Japanese title that is Kiga Kaikyo, which stars Rentaro Mikuni.
Ah.
He's an actor who's in things like The Burmese Heart. And
he's in a Naruse film.
Yeah, he's worked with everyone. I mean, he's still alive, actually. He's a very old man now, but he's done tons and tons of movies. Mikuni stars in Fugitive from the Past as a guy who, I forget the specifics of the plot, but he commits a murder. And then he flees and kind of goes on with his life. And it's sort of like Imamura's Vengeance is Mine, in that it's this epic film about a guy who's a murderer who's on the run. But in the Uchida film, it's about a guy who kind of puts himself back into a normal life, but there happens to be a detective who's after him. So he's changed his name and he becomes sort of a respectable citizen. And even though the murder is kind of a minor element in his past, but it basically winds up ruining him because he doesn't deal with it at the time. Really, really great movie. It's not owned in the U.S. by anybody. And hopefully they'll be showing that at BAM. Back to Jinsei Gekijo, from the description, it sounds like it's a classical, what they would call a Ninkyo Yakuza film, which is an honorable Yakuza movie, which kind of is like a... I mean, these things were as codified as Westerns in Japan, where you'd have a hero... Usually comes back to town or out of prison or something.
And it's always the same shot of prison. It's that long shot of the big concrete
wall. A big concrete wall in the snow, usually. Yeah. They get out of prison, they come back to their gang. Things have changed. Or there's another gang in town that's acting dishonorably and they have to do set things right. And the classic tension, the dynamic in these Ninkyo Yakuza films is between Giri and Ninjo. Giri being like duty to your gang, to the code, and Ninjo being what you want to do in your own heart. So you come back to town, you reunite with your old flame, you'd love to retire from the gang and go live a happy life in the country, but Giri demands that you avenge the murder of your younger brother, that the evil
your
gang,
buddy,
your buddy,
someone,
your boss, whatever. And it always winds up with the hero walking slowly down the alley, carrying a short sword to decimate the enemy headquarters, accompanied by the title theme song, usually sung by the lead star. And, you know, snow falling or cherry blossoms falling or something, and they go in and they kill everyone in the end. These things were like as codified as a Roy Rogers Western, although much better. And I expect, because Jinsei Gekijo stars two of the top Ninkyo Yakuza actors, Ken Takagura and Koji Tsuruta, it's going to be that, but just done really, really well.
Yeah. Well, the best thing about these movies, because, I mean, you know, at a certain point, the cataloging of them gets really dizzying, because it's totally unknown to most people over here. But I think that I want someone to put together one of these series that's more bound to the time. Because this is the 60s. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is the 60s were completely fucked up and great all over the world. You know, you had the barricades in France and the student movements. In Japan, you had all the left-wing movements and the farmers' riots. In China, you had the Cultural Revolution starting. Hong Kong, you had riots. I mean, it was really the same all over the world. I've always wanted to see someone, like, I've always thought what would be a great double feature is United Red Army, the Koji Wakamatsu movie, with the Fukusaku Battles with Without Honor, you know, all five of them. Just this, you know, everyone was reacting by making these action movies and Yakuza movies and, you know, sort of jumping in here with, like, you know, there are no bets, traditions are all off. And so many of these Yakuza movies end with the hero, wounded, stumbling down the street into an uncertain future, bleeding from several different stab wounds. I mean, gangster VIP. You know, he's wandering away, you know, bleeding. Colt is my passport. He wanders off at the end in that big way. It's like a Samuel Beckett play, you know? It's like, off he goes into the void to fuck someone up, kill himself, who knows?
Well, that's really the kind of thing that can happen, you know, really only in Japanese films, because you've got, you know, a hero who is defined by the relationship to a group, the gang, the family, the mob, whatever, and they've destroyed that. They've severed those ties, and especially in Japan, you know, the individual, the loner, is, you know, not a really respected kind of character, and that's kind of not a character that really is well defined. Even in samurai movies, when you had a lone ronin or something, it's always somebody who's scorned. Maybe a cool character, you know, the Japanese audiences think that lone wanderer hero is really cool, but they're also to be pitied because they don't have a place, they don't have a home. And when you have an ending like that, it's really, it's a very downbeat ending.
And that is all those Yakuza movies, man. Like, from Joe Shishido on, Tetsuya Watari, all those guys, they're scum. I mean, they're sort of heroic in the context of the film, but they go out of their way to show how sleazy and lame and suspicious these guys are.
They don't fit in.
Well, let me interject something, because I see the second film on the list is by a director named Yasuzu Masumura, I believe the film that he did that's not in this series, was it Branded to Kill?
No, but I have seen the one with
Yukio Mishima. Mishima in the lead.
Afraid to Die.
Thank you very much. I'm curious, because that's actually the only Masumura film I've seen, but I wonder, does that particular film fit into the genre we're talking about, or is that something different? Because
Afraid to Die...
Because what you were talking about, Brady, about the 60s and stuff, I mean, Mishima sort of fits into that kind of time period as well, and so I wonder if his...
also insane.
I mean, of course, and he's insane, like the 60s.
Let me jump ahead. Yeah. Bodybuilder.
Yeah, exactly. And but I'm curious if, like, if that's part of the genre, if that fits in somewhere, like having him in the lead, if that's something of interest to, like, you know, bring into this discussion here. Or,
I was just going to point out, because I have so little knowledge here at this point, that one of the last film in the series is by Fukusaku, and the movie they're not showing is Black Lizard by Fukusaku, which does feature Mishima as a quote-unquote human statue. He's trying very hard not to move and succeeding very poorly. And Masamura made Blind Beast, which showed at Japan Society a couple of years ago, and I saw it there. And if you haven't seen it and you'd like to see the S&M death couple movies, handle S&M death couple movies, you should watch that, preferably with, like, someone else in the dungeon. Like, I'd recommend it highly.
Cutting off each other's limbs. Yeah, I have not actually watched Afraid to Die, which is too bad, because I've had the DVD for a long time. From what I can tell, it's a you know, Yakuza-involved film, but I don't know if it really fits snugly into a Yakuza, one of the Yakuza genres, because Masamura wasn't really known as a Yakuza director.
Okay.
I mean, Masamura, I was talking about this recently with a friend, it's like a crime that Masamora is not better known and respected in the U.S. And it's
it's
always going to be a mystery to me why certain filmmakers from Japan are exalted in the U.S. or in Europe. I mean, Masamura is actually better known in Europe. He's really big in France.
He's had kind of a revival in the last few years. There are about 5 or 6 movies that came out in DVD. What's that movie about the Giants and Toys or whatever?
Giants and Toys.
Right. Like 4 or 5 others, actually.
Yeah, the test car, I just
saw. That's all. Fantoma Films has thankfully been doing 5 or 6 Masamura films from Gaia Studios from the 60s, which is great, but there's a lot more out there.
And what I was saying was that in this book, Movie Mutations, which Adrian Martin and Jonathan Rosenbaum edited, Rosenbaum has a conversation with a Japanese film critic, sort of a, back and forth email exchange, and also an in-person exchange about Masamura specifically, and they sort of, I think he relates Masamura here from his Western perspective to what the Japanese critic talks about Howard Hawks, and kind of brings them into some kind of comparative thing. Yeah. So Masamura
has talked about in some ways. A lot of films continue. That he's really well respected in Japan. I mean, as much as anybody from the past is respected in Japan as a filmmaker. And it's a crime that he's not known better here, and it's...
And who do you feel is exalted over him?
I mean, Kurosawa, Ozu, Nomura, Oshima, Ichikawa.
Wrongly so, or is it just that, do you think they're wrongly exalted?
He certainly deserves to stand alongside them, and he's so unknown here. I mean, even when you look at something like Criterion or, you know, film scholars here who deal with Japanese film, and he's not that well known because his stuff was not really available with subtitles. Fantoma, again, has put out 5 or 6 of his films.
Yeah.
I think maybe 1 or 2 others are available from other companies, but Masamura, I mean, it's got to be somebody that someday will write an interesting essay or book on why certain filmmakers from Japan or from other countries where the language is so different from in the U.S., like, you know, not France or Italy or Sweden, but Russia or Japan or something where, or China, where just through some fluke of film festival entries, they aren't known. Like, in the 60s, if Masamura's films had been better represented at film festivals by Daiei, the studio that was producing them, instead of, I don't know who a comparable Daiei filmmaker would be, but instead of, like, Toho sending off the Kurosawa films, or Shochiku sending off Imamura, or rather Oshima films, maybe he'd be better known. I mean, it's really strange that just through some weird quirk 40 years ago, there's no legacy around. You know, the Kurosawa films have been in distribution forever. Janus Films bought them in the 50s, put them out in the 60s in the U.S., a non-theatrical exhibition. These things are, every given weekend, a Kurosawa film is playing somewhere in America, on television, in theaters.
Yep. I mean, imagine if it had been Harakiri instead of Seven Samurai, or Samurai Rebellion instead of Yojimbo. I mean,
Kobayashi is thankfully, you know, kind of known, but not as much as Kurosawa.
Kobayashi is amazing. I mean, I actually like him a lot more than Kurosawa.
And Kobe, what's his full name?
I actually do too.
Masaki Kobayashi.
You can't have an opinion about Kurosawa. You know what I mean? It's like there's no entry point.
Plus, the ones I like are the ones that no one else... I like High and Low, and I think, you know, Yojimbo and...
For whatever reason,
you've got off into the sunset or whatever.
You know, Masamura has this enormous catalog of films that are really only known in Japan. He's got a couple of films. I haven't watched them. I dubbed them when I was in Japan last. I haven't watched them yet. Called Electric Jellyfish, Denki Karage, which, what people say, are just incredible, like, sort of sexy youth films about a young woman who can't get enough, as they say.
All right.
But getting back to the movie that they're showing at Asia Society, his Heitai Yakuza, or Hoodlum Soldier, is not a Yakuza film, despite the title. It's more of a war movie. It takes place during the Manchurian conflict, and it's about... The main character is a young... He's an intellectual. I think he's a doctor or something, but he's drafted. He's a draftee into the Manchurian War. The movie is... You were saying about the comparison with Howard Hawks. I think it's definitely good, except that Masamura was much more subversive throughout his career. You look at something like Giants and Toys and Black Test Car, which are incredibly subversive movies.
Right.
And Heitai Yakuza is the same way, where it's just bitingly anti-war film about the Manchurian conflict, you know, something that a lot of left-wing and progressive Japanese are just really hateful about, the fact that the Asian prosperity sphere, you know, taking over other Asian countries in the name of sort of exalting the Asian race, and all the stuff that happened pre-World War II. So you've got this, you know, intellectual character who's drafted into the army and is just miserable. He's getting beaten up by fellow soldiers. He's getting beaten up by his superior officers, which was allowed and encouraged in the Japanese army, of physical abuse, of slapping around, as a means of punishment. And he gets out of this by befriending a Yakuza, who's been drafted also, played by Shintaro Katsu, better known as Zatoichi in the Zatoichi films. Huge star in Japan. And this series, the Heitai Yakuza, became a series of about 10 films starring Katsu and this other guy and their various adventures in the Manchurian front. They wind up escaping from the army at the end of this film. I don't think that's much of a spoiler. And in later films, just different things about trying to get back to Japan. But it's a great movie. It's like more of a black comedy about their misadventures. And the joke is that this guy, who's this kind of wimpy intellectual guy, befriends this dumb ox of a Yakuza, who's just this tough bastard who can take all the punishment everybody can dish out. So not only do you have scenes of Shintaro Katsu getting the shit kicked out of him by his superior officers, but he can take it. He dishes it out to the guys who are abusing his friend. So it's this like mismatch. It's, you know, maybe like a buddy, you know, sort of a buddy movie idea, but really, really great. Just like mixed political commentary with black comedy.
And they're trying to get back home.
They're trying to just get the hell away. They're
so
just
it's
trying
like planes,
to
trains, and automobiles. But
well, they don't quite get that far. Yeah, it's more like trains. Yeah, they.
I don't suppose there's a hand between two pillows scene.
But it's about, there is a scene where they share a prostitute together.
Oh, well,
so it's basically
there we go.
A remake. Yeah. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
It's a really, really good movie. And
John Hughes, We Hardly Knew You.
It's not owned in the U.S. by anybody, and. As I said, it's not really a Yakuza film, and that it's not about the Yakuza. It just features a character who is one, but
it has Yakuza in the title. It's
highly worthwhile
this
movie.
Series seems like to be the big thing right now.
Let's try to get free tickets for the series, shall we?
Oh yeah, I think they will love this.
And I second Vadim's recommendation of Blind Beast, which is something that everybody should have in their collection. It's just one of the most twisted movies, but one of my absolute favorites of Japanese cinema. It's based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story, and he's like the Edgar Allan Poe of Japan, and yeah, it's just jaw-droppingly good.
What about some more in this series?
Red Peavy Gambler, I mean, it seems like the only real standout is that it has the female Yakuza as in the whole...
It's not bad, you've seen it.
Oh,
I mean,
it's more than not bad, yeah.
You like it a lot more than
I love it.
This is Red Peony Gambler by Tai Kato?
Tai Kato. If you want to say, if there's one name that's associated with classic Yakuza movies, it's Tai Kato.
Okay.
Tai Kato, again, not known in the U.S. None of his films have ever been out on DVD legally in the U.S.
They did a retro for him at the Japan Society.
They did. They did a retro of his a few years ago, and there's one of his movies that for some reason has been making the rounds at some film retro. It's called A Man's Face. It's his personal history. And Midnight Eye reviewed it not long ago, but it's a Yakuza film that he did, a modern day one, like a guys in dark glasses and suits, you know, post-World War II Yakuza film, starring famous real-life Yakuza, ex-real-life Yakuza, Noboru Endo, who's also in the Battles of That Honor series. But this one, Hibouton Bakuto, the Red Peony Gambler film, this is the third one in the series directed by Tai Kato. Kato did two or three in the series, there's I think seven of them, starring Junko Fuji, who's still working, actually. She just appeared in a movie called Accuracy of Death under her new name, Sumiko Fuji. But she is, like, the most famous female Yakuza star from the 60s. She retired for quite a while before coming back in the 80s. But Hibouton Bakuto series is just great. I mean, it's like, if you want to talk about the most... sort of the best example of a traditional Ninkyo Yakuza film, this series really is it, despite the fact that it's a female Yakuza. It's always, again, the storyline is like, you know, as well established as an American Western. You know, woman drifts from town to town, she's a gambler, she's kind of disgraced, but people respect her, she reunites with an old flame. The old flame has come back to town. There's something that an evil gang in town has done wrong, and the two of them storm the gang headquarters at the end, and much carnage ensues. In this one, I forget who her lover is. I think it might be Ken Takakura. I know he starred with her in several of them. and just the chemistry between the two of them is great. I mean, I absolutely love this series, and this one is the most famous and by all accounts the best one. This one has the, I guess, honor of being Paul Schrader's favorite Yakuza film. Paul Schrader's brother was
Leonard Schrader.
Leonard Schrader, you know, wrote Mishima. He actually wrote several Japanese films,
right,
including The Man Who Stole the Sun and one of the Torosan movies. But Leonard Schrader was like immensely steeped in Japanese culture, and this one was one of his favorites, and so on and so on and so on. But these guys know Yakuza movies, and by all accounts, this is their favorite movie of theirs. If there's one movie in this five film series I recommend you go see, it's this Red Peony Gambler Flower Cards match, because two of the others are on DVD already in the US and the other two are good, but this one is like, if you want to say Yakuza movie with a capital Y, Red Peony Gambler is it.
Although, Grady, did I sense that you're not as big a fan of Red Peony Gambler?
I'm not as big of a fan just because I don't know enough about the movies to appreciate the formula. You know, like, Red Peony Gambler, it's good. It's visually good. It's interesting. It's a good movie, but to me, like, it doesn't jump out at you, you know? But you know enough about the formula and the actors and everything.
It is really formulaic. And, I mean, some might even say hokey. I mean, all of these early 60s Ninkyo films are early and even late 60s Ninkyo films are so formulaic. Like, you can set your watch by the time that, you know, she reunites with her lover, they go and storm the evil gang's headquarters. So there's a lot of people who prefer the 70s Yakuza films, the kind of true-life ones, the Fukusaku-inspired, grittier, more violent
like
ones.
Me.
Yeah, I mean, I love them too, but there's something... There's just something romantic about these older ones.
But you like westerns, too.
Yeah, I like westerns.
And westerns drive me crazy. Like, you like genre.
Yeah, and if you would say the Fukusaku ones, I guess you would compare to, like, the Peckinpah westerns.
Yeah.
And the Ninkyo ones, more like really good John Ford westerns.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, yeah, but you're absolutely right. If someone's going to see something in this, they should see Red Peony Gambler, simply because the best movie in the lineup, which is Battles with Honor and Humanity, is easily available on
DVD.
Yeah,
you can see that on IFC
and
or DVD.
Frankly, it's ridiculous just to watch Battles with Honor and Humanity. You've got to watch the whole series. I mean, all five films, when you put them together, it's like The Wire, basically, for the Japanese Yakuza. It's characters cross and come in and go out, and main characters become supporting characters. And I mean, it's a phenomenal achievement.
Yeah. Doesn't the box set have like an entire genealogy of who belongs to which gang, who left?
It is. It's hard to keep track. I mean, it's not necessary really to keep track.
You don't.
Enjoy
just
the
give
movies.
Yourself up to it.
And you seem to be bringing up something here too about genre versus I don't know postmodern deconstruction or something. Is that what we're? Is that
there is one Saijun Suzuki film in the series which I think would kind of highlight the difference. Although
I think it's a really
from '65, I'm not sure.
A weird entry for Suzuki film. I mean,
which movie is that?
Tattooed Life.
Irizumichidai.
Kanto Wanderer.
No. Tattooed Life.
Which one's Tattooed Life?
It's on DVD in the U.S. It's
Seishun Suzuki?
Yeah.
Is that the one where the guy hides out in the mining town, or is that Kanto Wanderer?
No, Tattooed Life. Yeah, he hides out, he brings his brother, or
he hides out with his brother, and he falls in with the chick who's... Yeah.
But then they have that
gorgeous final scene, which is with the in the complete darkness with the gunshots.
Yeah.
But it's,
I just think it's like a weird... I mean, it's a weird Suzuki film to bring into life, but it seems like this entire series is... I mean, Hentai Yakuza is part of a 10-part series.
Seven or eight parts or something, yeah.
And then Red Peony is part of it, is a three-part.
Six or seven, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, like, how...
That's typical, though, of a lot of Yakuza series. They kind of go on forever.
But would these be the ones that you would show in order to introduce an audience? I mean, there's, like, so much...
Oh, you could... I mean, it would be difficult... You're also constricted, obviously, if you're an American cinema taker, you're constricted by what's available with English subtitles. I mean, there's tons of other Yakuza films that you might show, but they just aren't available. I mean, there might not even be unsubtitled prints around there.
I mean, the big issue is access. I mean...
It is. I've never heard of Jinsei Gekijo, the Tale of Two Yakuza showing, so... I don't know where they found that print. The other four I know have shown other places in the U.S. So
yeah,
they're easy to get.
You guys have probably dealt with this a lot with the New York Asian Film Festival, but I mean, how hard is it to get an older film?
Close to impossible.
Yeah.
I had someone email recently because they were looking for a Chinese ghost story, the classic Hong Kong film, and A Better Tomorrow, the classic John Woo film. I didn't know what to say to him. You just have to laugh. Like, these movies are just, they've all been sold off in lots. No one's kept track of who the licensor is. And once you find the licensor, you run into the issue of finding a print, which is almost impossible now. I mean, for a lot of these movies from the 80s. So, you know, it's funny. It's weird. DVD's great, and nothing against it. But, you know, I'm lucky to have been around when Peter Chan was screening those Hong Kong series at Cinema Village in the early 90s, because you got to see a lot of this stuff on the big screen while it was still doing the Chinatown circuit, while there was a Chinatown circuit. Now it's almost impossible to get this stuff. You couldn't put together a series of classic Hong Kong films with prints, with subtitles, without spending a lot of money and having a lot of pull in terms of influence.
Either that, or you have to go to the private collector. You know, which is even harder. You know?
I've done that, and I've got cease and desist letters from people in Hong Kong. Yeah.
They don't like to hear about that if the companies don't own the rights.
And, you know, it's just the prints are undervalued. I mean, when the Music Palace, the big Chinatown movie theater, the last one remaining, when that sort of got sold, Subway Cinema begged. I mean, we tracked down the person it got sold to. We begged. We went in. We're like, because they said they'd found some prints in the basement. Well, it turned out to be 421 prints and 700-something trailers and a couple of thousand posters and lobby cards. So we went in the middle of winter and spent, like, a couple of weeks cataloging the whole thing. We set up a deal with these guys to sell it all to a private collector. I mean, we were finding stuff like Chor Yun films. Like, Chor Yun, who did The Magic Blade and all that stuff. He had done a musical called An Evening in Paris. It's virtually unseen. It stars Leslie Jung and Anita Mui when they're, like, 17 and 18 years old. It's a musical. I mean, I'd never seen this thing before. I mean, you know, four prints of Hard Boiled, two of A Bullet in the Head. Just amazing stuff. And ultimately, the owner he thought he was being taken advantage of with the collector's bids. And the last I saw these prints, they were in a basement with 4 inches of water, with water coming down over. I mean, they're gone. This was 2 years ago, and those prints are ruined now. These prints just aren't valued, and they all wound up going out on the circuit, and they wound up staying wherever the last year that played them was, and eventually getting thrown in a dumpster. And, you know, it's sad, but these movies are gone for the most part. You know, Shaw Brothers were the only people who really kept a tight lock on Chinese films and their masters.
Because they never opened their vaults, that's why.
Until recently, you know.
So for all intents and purposes, there are a lot of blocks of films from China and other Asian countries.
Not so much Japan.
Japan's easier because everything was controlled by studios that still exist.
Okay.
Even though the studios may have gone bankrupt and come back around, they're still the same studio. Yeah.
Hong Kong, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Korea, they all had independent production companies and then independent distributors and exhibitors. They didn't have the kind of like Japan had, which is, and like Shaw Brothers was, which was top down and Shaw Cathay. I mean, they had come and go companies who came, they went, they got bankrupt.
Or you have libraries that go back and forth, like the, Media Asia, the libraries that Media Asia had are now owned by Fortune Star.
Yeah.
So everything, you know, every 5 years, it goes from one company to another.
In Japan, these studios have been around.
Always the same.
Since the
For the most
teens.
Part. Yeah. And there are some things that are harder to find. Subject of a whole other show, but there was an independent production company called the Art Theater Guild, ATG, in the 60s in Japan, that was formed literally like by artists and by sort of avant-garde people. And they would do co-productions with major studios. And then some of them would be distributed by the major studios. Some of them would be actually co-produced by the major studios. And when I was working at a video company, we tried to look into the rights of some of the ATG films, you know, which were like directors like Shuji Terayama and Susumu Hani and Ichikawa and Oshima and Imamura and so on. And in terms of licensing the rights for a video exhibition in the U.S., it's very difficult because you've got like three or four companies that have their hands in it.
Well, after all that, I think it's fitting that we then go out on the final film of the series, which is the Sam Peckinpah of Yakuza films, The Battles Without Honor and Humanity. Jingi Nakatakai. Also, and it would then be remade later in mid-90s, 2000?
Later than that.
No,
Takashi Miike did one?
No, not Miike. It was Miike. It was just like a... Who did Shin...
There was in the 90s, there was a... I forget the director's name, but there was a semi-remake. sort of using the same title.
Mika used the same title too.
Not of the Jingi films. It was Jingi no Hakaba, which is Graveyard of Honor.
Oh, Graveyard of Honor.
Yeah, Mika renamed that, which is a 1975 film that Fukasaki did, which is great, starring Tetsuya Watari. Now this one, the first Jingi no Gatarakai film is. It's a landmark movie that was based on a series of newspaper articles that were done in Tokyo about a real-life gangster. And I think the guy who wrote the articles collaborated with Fukasaki, I might be wrong about that, on the screenplays, and developed it into this film, which just was, you know, seismic in its effect. And they quickly churned out four more sequels. Directed by Fukasaku, then three more sequels in the Shin or new Jingi no Gatarakai series that were directed by Fukasaku. Two of them. Third one was directed by somebody else. Then there were follow-ups and side stories, and you name it. It was kind of a cottage industry, but it really displayed like Fukasaku's contribution to what was called the Jitsuroku. Or True Story, the Yakuza film, to be distinguished from the Ninkyo films that we were talking about. The Ninkyo films, like Red Genie Gambler, which are, you know, not Technicolor, but whatever the Japanese equivalent is, big, beautiful colors, widescreen, studio-bound, you know, kimonos, swords, beautiful sets, cherry blossoms, pretty people. The Jitsuroku films were all about handheld, in the street, guys in aviator sunglasses and cheap suits, guns, mud, dirt, post-war black markets, scumbags, assholes, pimps, hookers, drug addicts. It was like, as the title suggests, or as the name suggests, the true story. They were based on true events. And what Fukasaku, I think, did was show that the Yakuza are not your nice guys who protect the, you know, we're friends of widows and orphans and protect the weak. They're really just scumbags who are out for themselves. And the point of all of his films are, there may be one guy, like the Bunta Sugawara character, the lead character of all five of the first series of the Jingi films, who tries to adhere to the code, code of Jingi, you know, which is what they translate as honor and humanity. But everybody else in the gang is just an utter scumbag who are out for personal profit, personal gain, fucking over their gang members and their boss to get rich. And nobody cares about that anymore.
Yeah, and also I think what was refreshing for the audience is the Yakuza formula was pretty dead, you know, at that point. All the earlier movies, so this was at least something new. And it was very non-judgmental. I find all the Fukasaku gangster movies extremely non-judgmental. You know, there's not a good guy, there's not a bad guy, there's no battle between tradition and modernity. It's all modern. You know, it's the 70s.
It's all about gray lines, yeah. I mean, even the heroes, you know, routinely rape two or three women and, you know, turn them into prostitutes in the films. And these are the good guys.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's, you know, it might be a little hard for sort of a Western audience to embrace, but, I mean, the hero of the one that Grady was talking about, the Graveyard of Honor that was remade by Yakuza, is one of my favorite scenes where he's having sex with his prostitute girlfriend in a flop house surrounded by other people, and she's shooting him up with heroin while she's riding on top of it. And she's the one who first hooks him on heroin, which is what eventually kills him.
It's good to have a dream, you know?
You know, if that's not living the high life, I don't know what it is. And it's really, I mean, the great thing that, one of the many great things that Fukasaku did in his films, among other directors, was it was about the everyman. He was like, after the war, who were the real heroes of Japan?
Yeah.
It were these guys who just were in the black markets, doing what they could to survive, and they created created the Japanese future.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I mean, after the war, Japan was occupied and was being told how their constitution was going to be written. Their laws were being enforced by Americans and foreigners for the most part, and collaborators, you know? I mean, it was like Vichy era France, except in Japan, and the sides were switched around. I mean, depending on where you're looking. And so, yeah, who were the heroes but the people making the future, which were sort of saying, fuck tradition and fuck the law. This isn't even our law. And, you know, the people forging a future. And that's the great thing about the Battles Without Humanity, Battles Without Honor and Humanity series is it ties in with not just gangsters fighting over turf, but it comes about industry and business and how they made money for politicians and how people ran for office.
Okay, I mean, don't forget how it starts with the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
I mean, the first image is the atomic bomb.
And the last image is the Hiroshima.
memorial, that wrecked observatory, isn't it?
Yeah, because the movies are about the Hiroshima and Kobe gangs
in
western Japan. My favorite films in the series, the first five films in the series are actually number 3 and number 4.
Yeah, 3 and 4.
Number
2
is sort of an independent side story, but number 3 and number 4 are sort of tied together, and they're in this box set that's on DVD from Home Vision in the U.S.
Five stakes.
That I totally recommend. But number 3 and number 4 are almost like a continuous story among the two of them about the gangs getting involved with politicians and industrialists. And of course, given Fukusaku's very left-wing predilections, the politicians and the industrialists are the biggest scumbags of the entire series. The most corrupt, the most, you know, self-serving, the most willing to fuck over everybody that's around them for a buck and for success. So, you know, compared to them, it's like the Yakuza, the guys who are, you know, the low-level pimps and gamblers are nothing compared to these guys who are the heads of corporations and industry.
On that note, I think we will wrap up the podcast. Quick round the table, no explanation needed. Favorite Yakuza film?
Well, if I had to choose right now out of the back of my head, I'd have to pick two. Favorite Ninkyo film and favorite Jitsuroku film. Favorite Jitsuroku film, probably, it's not really even a Jitsuroku film, but you know what? Screw it. Favorite Yakuza film of all time, I'll pick one. It's an early, fairly early Fukusaku film, I think from 62 or 63, made for Toei Studios, called Wolves, Pigs, and Men.
Wolves, Pigs, and People.
Yeah, Okami to Ningen. Okami to Buta to Ningen.
64.
Wolves, Pigs, and People, yeah, 64.
Yeah.
Starring Rentaro Mikuni, who we talked about, Ken Takakura, and Kinya Kiteoji. And it's about three brothers who decided to rip them off and suffer the consequences, and it's just one of the best, kind of combining the romantic elements of the older early 60s Yakuza films, the gritty, it's black and white, it takes place in the slums, and combining that with kind of the gritty elements of the 70s Yakuza films, totally great, not distributed in the US, there's a subtitle print that goes around sometimes, but if you keep your fingers crossed, maybe some American distributor will pick it up.
For me, I have to say, as much as I love the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, if I had to pick one, I'd say Black Tight Killers. It's not technically a Yakuza movie, but it's part of the... It's an Akatsu film.
It's an Akatsu film, yeah.
Akatsu film from that period, from their mood action period. And it's on DVD, and it's absolutely fantastic. Although I would also say Youth of the Beast. The Suzuki Seijin film is also another phenomenal Yakuza movie. Both films are designed within an inch of their lives. They're gorgeous to watch.
I'm such a neophyte in this area that I have to defer to these gentlemen and educate myself. So
Dead or Alive, Takashi Miike fingers the single greatest ending of all time of any movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I like
and
the rest of it
beginning.
Too.
Single greatest beginning.
I'm the only person who likes the middle, as far as I know.
Yeah,
that's how it goes.
And I have a quick note. I really like Dead or Alive too. I like that more than the first Dead or Alive. But,
I like Dead or Alive too.
It's actually another Miike film. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a really long cut made, and then they released a shorter version.
Oh, Agitator.
Agitator. Yes. The Kim's on Bleecker, Once Upon a Time When It Existed, had a VHS copy of the original feature-length version. It was washed out. It was the best time I ever had watching a film. That said, Tokyo Drifter, that fucking theme song stays in my head for days.
And speaking of Tokyo Drifter, which is an Akatsu film, let me put a plug in here for the series I'm programming at Japan Society, which is the No Borders, No Limits 1960s Nikatsu Action Cinema, which has been going on one per month since last September. We've got four more films to go. I think this is going to be aired after the Friday the 22nd screening of Gangster VIP starring Tetsuya Watari from Tokyo Drifter. But in March, we've got a Eastern Western called Plains Wanderer on March 14th. In April 4th, we've got a Joe Shishido film called Glass Johnny, which is kind of a remake of La Strada with a twist. You have to see it to understand it. And then in May, the beginning of May, is Roughneck, which is a true Yakuza film, a Ninkyo film starring Akira Kobayashi and directed by Yasuharu Hasebe, who did Black Tie Killers.
And just before we go, can we tell where this series is going to be that we've talked about today?
It'll be in the hearts and minds of children across the world, which is also known as the Asia Society, from March 6th to April 17th, 2008. And you can find the Asia Society at 725 Park Avenue. So, once again, special thanks to Grady and Mark. Thank you so much for coming out and talking.
Thanks for having us. Our festival starts June 20th.
Well, I hope actually we do one of these around the festival or before the festival once
we would love to have you come back
to
the for the preview. This will be episode 4 of Liquor and Resolve Live at Grassroots Tavern. Vadim and I are big in Japan.
Episode 4 is getting like a Yakuza series.
Yeah, no, it's actually really good.